definitely use the phone to buy, you know, to find a restaurant or a car. That's wonderful. But do not use it to buy and sell stocks. You will lose.
Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, a financial advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services.
And I'm Jess DeBear, Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passion. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, joining us today is entrepreneur, best-selling author, spokesperson, and children's advocate, Neil Godfrey. She is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and her views are her own.
Wow. Well, with that great necessary disclaimer, let's see who's stopping by.
How do you feel about this? This is probably a topic right up your alley. Like, you're in the zone here for these types of conversations.
Because I have two kids approaching college.
Yeah, man. The way I look at it is like, this is the fourth quarter. You're about to send them off into the real world. And this is like your last, you're cramming before the final exam. You're like, I want to make sure you know this and this and this.
Yeah, I feel pretty crammy. I got to be honest. We actually recently had a sit-down discussion with the boy. And, you know, we talked about what we have saved for him so far. We told him the number and we told him, you know, what these colleges cost per year. Do the math. There will be student loans if we go to this college. If we go to this college, maybe not so much. So he is fully aware. We've been very transparent. Parents.
I'll tell you what, we're working on hollers right now. We're pretty good with numbers. Pretty good with, we like the word no. We don't like the word yes. Not a big yes guy. Financial education, it seems like a whole world off. So I'm intrigued. I got a lot of time to get lessons under my belt so we can start coaching these guys.
Okay, but I'm just saying, you think you have a lot of time and then you're going to blink. You're going to go from colors to periodic table to college.
Just like that.
Just like that. It's crazy. Doug, should we see you stopping by today?
Let's find out.
All right, folks, I am beyond excited to have this guest today because not only is she absolute awesome sauce, she is our second New York Times bestselling author to stop by. We are on a roll. Today, we are chatting with female executive pioneer, financial education spokesperson, business owner, and author, Neil Godfrey. Neil, a fellow Jersey girl, started her career at Chase Manhattan Bank as one of the first female executives and later became president of the First Women's Bank. From there, she formed her own company, Children's Financial Network. She has served as a national spokesperson for companies including Microsoft and Coca-Cola, and has appeared multiple times as a financial expert on programs including the Oprah Winfrey Show. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of her. Yeah. Katie Couric. Yeah. No, some other noted people.
Also, she has appeared on Good Morning America and The Today Show. She has authored several books, including Money Doesn't Grow on Trees, A Parent's Guide to Raising Financially Responsible Children. And her latest, Be Money Smart in Tough Times. As you can see, I have tabbed and highlighted my copy. She has earned a laundry list full of awards and accolades and has made it her life's work to deliver this message. Empower yourself to take control over your financial life. And it's my pleasure to bring Neil Godfrey to you all today. Neil, thank you for stopping by.
It's so great to be here with you guys. Yay.
There were quite a lot of accolades there. And you didn't get to all of them. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, Neil, is I'm looking through all your awards. And one of them is the Muriel Siebert Lifetime Achievement Award. Getting a Lifetime Achievement Award is very impressive. Mm. Is there any of these that mean more to you than others?
The one that I really liked was from the United Nations, and it was Child Advocate Award.
Oh, wow.
Child Advocate on a global basis. So it wasn't just the U.S. And that, you know, that's what my work is about, to empower kids around the world to take charge of their life. So that was kind of cool.
before you hopped on, Doug and I were chatting about our childhoods and talking about what our earliest memories are surrounding money. Can you share with us what yours is?
When I was 6 years old, I started my first business. A neighbor grew grapes, but some of them were very close to the fence in my backyard. And those grapes hung over in my yard. So what I did, which I thought was very clever, I knew he was making wine. I wasn't sure what wine was, but I went and I looked at a bottle of Chianti. And you know how the woman with the holding the thing of grapes?
Yeah.
She's got a babushka and she's got an apron and she's got everything. What I did was I picked the grapes that were hanging on my side. I got a basket from downstairs, my mother's apron, and a scarf around my head. And I dressed like what I thought was the woman on the Chianti bottle and went next door to sell them back their grapes that were hanging on my yard.
Really?
Brilliant.
So how did you start down the world of financial endeavors?
I landed at Chase Manhattan Bank after I graduated from college. Chase was looking for a woman who they could send through the training program to become an executive. I loved it, loved it, loved it. And I rose through the ranks, became an executive, and was lucky enough to put together in 1980 the largest merger that took place in the United States, the DuPont-Conoco merger. And we had to reprogram the Chase Manhattan Bank computers because they couldn't take the extra three zeros for the billions.
Wow.
I then knew I had sort of hit the ceiling, the glass ceiling, which wasn't glass in those days. It was kryptonite.
Mm-hmm.
I became president of the first woman's bank at age 34. And the reason we needed a woman's
34. Jeez.
Is that the Fair Credit Act had not been enacted until 1974. And before that time, women could not get credit with their own name. We needed a signature of a male. And my first credit card at Chase, and I was an executive. My then husband, then is the operative word, my then husband was a law student without any credit, but the card had to have his name on it. My credit card had his name with a permission slip from him for me to use my own credit.
Insane. Yet here you are, an executive at Chase Manhattan Bank, and I can't even wrap my head around it.
You know, when I got to the first women's bank, I watched women be uncomfortable handling their money. That's goofy. So I did research, and it was because we were never taught anything about money as kids. So my children, you know, I was now a divorced single mom of two little ones. I went to look for books to teach them about money. There were none, and that was wrong. So my three-year-old daughter said, Mommy, rather than take us to bookstore after bookstore, why don't you just write the books? And it was like, whoa, I know how to be a bank president and do deals and all this stuff. I do not know how to write books. I didn't articulate it. She saw the look on my face and she goes, oh, you're afraid.
No.
I go, no, I'm not afraid. Being the great mom I am. So I figured it out. So I wrote the kids' money book. You know, I researched how you write a kid's book and you have to entertain them. So I created cartoon characters called the Green Street Kids. And we are connected. And you guys in the financial world know this. We're connected by the way we handle money, not whether we're rich or poor. So you're born with a financial personality. You're basically a saver or a spender. Anyway, I created a line of cartoon characters. They're animals. The heroine is, of course, a woman.
Naturally.
Of course.
Blonde.
Blonde. Penny Bright. Today's savvy feline and entrepreneur. And she knows her fashion and her tax code. So I have a whole line of these guys. And they live in an imaginary village. They're the Market Brothers, Bull and Bear. And they run the Blue Chip Deli in Green Street Common, which is where they live, and they cook muffins and buns, and sometimes they burn the buns and they throw them away and they call them junk buns.
Oh, stop it. Stop the cuteness.
Wait, so all right, let's go back to that. You have a full-time job. You're at the Women's Bank. Is that when you started writing your first book? Or I also saw you moved to FEO Schwartz Bank?
Yeah. What happened was I went running into Simon & Schuster and said, ta-da, I have this book. We can educate kids around the world. We can empower them to take charge of their financial lives. Simon & Schuster said, thanks for stopping by. We're not going to take a risk on a topic that does not exist. So I made it about 2 weeks and I said, they need proof of concept. So I opened up the first children's bank at FAO Schwartz, a real bank, FDIC approved for kids, and also an institute for youth entrepreneurship up in Harlem to work with at-risk children to bring them into the economy. I didn't want to just work with rich kids at FAO Schwartz. Princess Diana flew over from England with the two royal children, babies, to
here.
Yes. Back to Simon & Schuster. Ta-da, proof of concept. Look at this. I started a greeting card company with these kids up in Harlem, taught them how to run a business. It's running. It's great. FAO Schwartz. We changed the traffic pattern at FAO on the weekends because there were so many people lined up at my little bank. And Simon & Schuster said, thanks for stopping by. There's still no books to teach kids about money. We're not going to take a risk on your cute idea. And then it was, put your big girl panties on. You know how to do mergers and acquisitions. So I bought a publishing company.
Take that, Simon & Schuster.
I did not want to run a publishing company. I wanted a book. Mm-hmm. So at the first publishing meeting, I explained to everyone very sweetly, I will fire all of you if you do not publish my book. And they made the decision to publish my book.
That's your Jersey roots, by the way. When you make them an offer they can't refuse. Yeah.
You know what? We're going to make this really simple. So anyway, we published Kids Money Book. I sold 50,000 copies, sold the publishing company to Scholastic, went back to Simon & Schuster and said, I'm back.
How do you like me now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now what? So they said, look at this. There's another book. I said, I am well aware of that. Anyway, so they took me on as a property, cute property. So they published it soft cover. And then one day the phone rang and my daughter, who was now 10, came running in and goes, Mommy, Oprah is on the phone. All right. It was Oprah. I worked with Oprah 4.5 years. I did 13 shows with Oprah. That book hit number one in the New York Times bestseller list. And that kind of changed everything. So Simon & Schuster all of a sudden became aware of
right.
me. And my price went way up.
Yeah, girl.
So anyway, I just finished my 29th book.
Incredible. I want to ask this question before I forget. What does Oprah smell like? Because I feel like a lavender scent or maybe like vanilla. Like I would want to get all up in her neck and like get in there before like the security guards would pry me away.
Yeah, they would pry you away and you wouldn't get that close. Very showered, very
fresh. Thank you, because I have been thinking this since we booked you. I have to ask the question.
Yeah.
We got to know what Oprah smells like. Perhaps more importantly, over the course of your career, can you tell us how the landscape for women in business has shifted and perhaps even more importantly, how it hasn't and why?
Well, when I joined Chase, women were earning, and there weren't many of us, 61 cents for every dollar a man earned. Today, we earn 82 cents, 83 cents, depending upon who you talk to. We're not there yet. What's interesting is when you really look at that, over my career at Chase for the 13 years and also for the pension or the lack thereof that I receive, the bonuses that I didn't get because I was a woman, it's cost me $2 million in money I did not receive. That's what the difference is. And I was on Governor Christie's gender parity committee for a while when he was governor. And he said to me, what are your goals? And I said, my goals are that we don't need a gender parity committee.
That's a good goal. A lot of times we'll march into a meeting and the woman who's earning more will say, my husband handles the investments. He knows more about that than I do. And I could just, I'm a guy. The guy starts talking and I'm like, no, he doesn't. he's just more confident in what he doesn't know. And so there, a lot of times there's a tendency to take a back seat to it. The reality is that this is not a topic. And I think that that's what's great about your whole line of education is that if we can just raise everybody to have the same level of financial acumen, you don't have these gender roles that persist for generations.
You've nailed it. And that's exactly what it is. And there's this baggage that has hung with us that women are not good in math. Women are not good with money. It's a whole gender thing. Oh, let the guy do it. I mean, I'm into letting the guy take the garbage out. I don't.
Amen, sister.
Yeah, don't think that I don't have gender bias. Right. And that baggage has come with us. And you guys know in your practice, if you have grandparents, there are some times that the woman in the role doesn't even know what there is. And women were told, don't worry, you're taken care of. So when you make money the biggest secret in the family, because polite people don't talk about money, we made that up, by the way. Money is the business part of a relationship. It shouldn't be emotional. It's not about the one who earns the most wins. It's about what you're doing in terms of your passion, and some things pay more than others. So we have to break that down. We have to make money a comfortable topic. And that's what I have worked to create.
I want to go back a little bit and think about, you had this job, you're working in a career, and then you made a risk to just follow this passion, this driven why. Tell us about that, making that decision to leave a job, following a passion and pursuing that. Was it always in you? Did you sort of discover it along the way? Because I'm certain we have people that have a passion that they're not following yet.
I had a conversation with myself literally in front of the mirror, because it was way easier to remain being a bank president. And then what happens is you get offered larger and larger banks. Okay. Or are you really going to make a difference? And that was the conversation. And it was very scary because I had two little kids. I was sole support. And it was, are you really going to do this? So one side is going, don't be ridiculous. It's a great, cute idea. And the other one is, really? Are you going to want to wake up 25 years from now and say, I didn't do this? I didn't make a difference for my kids. I didn't make a difference for other children. And then it was like, oh, hell, all right, I'll jump off the cliff. And one of my problems was, it was so obvious to me that we needed to educate our kids. And it was not obvious to other people.
So what advice would you give young women who are like you, who strive to become business owners?
The deal is, you have to find a problem that needs to be solved. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a need. Or you can look at something and say, I can do that better. So those are the two things. And know who your customer is. Know what the value add is. Know. And when I say know that customer, my customers basically, I mean, I have kids, but the women in the family are the ones who buy my book. And the thing is, know where she lives, what she's eating, what she does, what she cares about, how you can help her. What is she scared about? What does she want her kids to be when they grow up? You know, in terms of being financially independent, what does that look like? And I speak very personally to my audience because I get it. Been there, done that.
Mm-hmm. Doug, do you see all the notes I'm taking? I just want to make sure you're aware that I'm taking very...
Neil, you should know, Jess has, we were talking about this earlier, but Jess has teenagers. So I was saying it's like the fourth quarter. This is her last chance to cram and then send them out into the world. And at many times, I feel like with parents, they wait too long to have that money conversation. Like it's a lost cause at a certain point. So when do we bring it up?
It's never too late. That's number one. It's just different that you bring it up when they start saying and understanding what mommy and daddy do with money in a store. Now, it's the credit card today. And they know that you hand this magic piece of plastic to somebody and you get stuff. When they figure that out, that's when they figure out basically medium of exchange. What you do at that point is you start teaching them, and that's about 2 to 3 years old. You start teaching them the way you get money is to earn it. There's no entitlement program. It's not that you want for it and you get it. So mm-hmm. what you do is I set up a very simple work for pay system within the household, which is an allowance, and they work and they earn money. And then, you know, we take it from there in terms of learning to budget. What that is, and a budget's a habit.
So in this latest book, Be Money Smart in Tough Times, it's a guide for parents and grandparents on how to not raise entitled children. And you state, what kids don't know about money can hurt them, and bad financial habits in childhood can lead to worse problems when you're a grown-up. So what would you tell parents of significant means who might now have entitled teenagers who are going off the rails?
When they're older and they've been given everything their whole life, one of the things is you want to be able to rein them in. So when they go off to school, you say to them, hey, here's the deal. Number one, you're going to be on a budget. You know, you can say, hey, I'll pay for entertainment once a weekend, mm-hmm. but not three times a weekend, whatever you decide. And you fund that. That's number one. Do not give your credit card to your child going off to college. There's no accountability. It magically goes to you. And I was working with one parent in this situation. And the parent said to me, oh, no. He knows not to use the card unless it's an emergency. 3 months in, I got a call from the parents that he felt it was really important to go to Switzerland with six of his friends over spring break because they need it to decompress.
It was a mental emergency.
Thinking about this, we were talking about this again a little earlier, is that if you don't have the means, saying no is an easy way out. Mm-hmm. I don't have it. I felt growing up when I got a no, hey, it stops right there. We don't have it. What can I do? To me, I'm worried about if you do have it, how do you say no?
Money is about choices. It's my money, my choices. Let's talk about how the family earned, because somebody earned the money in the family at some point. And this is how we earned it. These are my values. These are my choices. And these are the things that I am going to teach you as a parent, because that's my job. My job as a parent is to teach you so that you have the values and life skills to live in the real world.
That's right. You are the bird launcher.
Bird launcher.
The bird launcher.
Bird launcher. I like that. Bird launcher.
I want to say that was my original. I don't think it is. But right. So instead of having an empty nest, you're a bird launcher. You're not an empty nester. You're a bird launcher.
You guys are really interested in helping your clients to raise that next generation of money. It's never about their money. It is about their kids. Yes. What is that going to mean? So I love working with people like you who are really helping those people not only to design their life, but the future generations. And that's what it's about. That's paying it forward.
You also mentioned in the book, in terms of teens, stocks should be part of their regular savings and investing plan without fear. Can you enlighten our listeners as to why?
Yeah, I mean, what you should do is part of that dinner conversation, that start talking about their world. You know, stocks are a reflection of what our universe is. Mm-hmm. And involve them in that. Teach them. Show them. Say, hey, what does Disney own? And I start when they're 10 years old. What are the other things Disney owns? Why would they own ABC? Why would they own ESPN? When there's a disaster and no one can go to Disney World, they don't go to the park. What would happen to their stock? And you explain to them what stock is. So start those conversations, those real life conversations. If there's a recession and you explain to them what that means, then you're in the grocery store. What are the things you're going to buy? Would you buy milk or would you buy soda? You start connecting those kids to real life.
I completely agree with you. I think about this all the time, raising children. How do I do this? But what you just described, it's the same conversation we have with adults when they're nervous about the market. Hi, do you still continue to go buy Pampers diapers? Do you still go continue to buy Tide for it to wash your clothes? When the markets are really chaotic, you have to sort of tether that narrative to companies they're familiar. This is the same conversation you have with adults when you get, we're trying to get them to invest and do the right things. You're just recommending doing it at an earlier age than most.
You pull stuff out, you know, from whatever they heard on the news. And then what I do is, even with the 10-year-olds, have them put together a basket of stocks. Obviously, you have to do it. So your client could set this up. And you let the child pick a few stocks. You know what? I don't care how they perform. It doesn't matter. You're teaching them to buy and hold. So they're going to buy stocks they know. So it would be Disney or Mattel. Hey, we went to the Barbie movie. Who owns the Barbie? All you're doing is letting them understand that the stock market is not some amorphous thing that's out there. And by the way, don't day trade because you're going to lose. We're going to buy and hold. I firmly believe it's important for people to take their teenage kids in to see you guys. Because they think they can do everything off the phone because they're smarter than we are. Definitely use the phone to find a restaurant or a car. That's wonderful. But do not use it to buy and sell stocks. You will lose.
Why do you think people are so afraid to talk about finances? Because when I grew up, we really did not talk about it. I had no idea how much money my parents made or what. I had no concept whatsoever. And my husband and I have been relatively transparent about what we earn and how we got this house. Why is there such a taboo around talking about money?
It's a Puritan value that came in, literally, with the Puritans. You didn't talk about money. Money was dirty. There were certain people that were allowed to have money, you know, to even handle money. And what I do is actually give kids language to handle when they're hit up by other friends. Are you rich? Because it is a taboo. It's okay to walk in and go, oh man, this costs so much and I don't have any money. You can't walk in and go, oh man, I am so rich. I'm
loaded.
My whole thing is that they have to understand with wealth comes responsibility. So I teach the kids part of the budget goes to charity. 10% comes off the top. Then I have something I call quick cash, which is instant gratification. They need to learn to deal with instant gratification. And when you buy it and the money's gone, it's gone. Then I teach them medium-term savings, which is to push off instant gratification, save for something larger. You get bigger stuff. And then long-term savings. And that's that goes into saving and then goes into the stock market. And that's what they get to invest in. Mm-hmm. And they learn. That's what it is. But we have to stop that taboo. With money goes that responsibility. Get the kids involved in what you give. Take them to the hospital. Take them to a soup kitchen. Take them with you. Do days of volunteering.
How would you envision the perfect way to bring financial literacy into the school?
To use my financial literacy curricula. In fact, one of the lessons I have is called License to Drive. And I have the kids, these are teenagers, I have them figure out what they would have to earn pre-tax to have the car of their dreams.
Oh, I love that.
Just to have the car of your dreams. By the way, you're not eating food. You don't live anywhere. You sleep in your car.
And now you need gas in it. You got to fix it.
Right. And you're naked. Right. And you have to get gas and you have to have maintenance. And I make them research the insurance and how come boys have higher insurance than girls. I make them go through the whole thing. And never, there has never been a time that the kids don't sit there with their mouths open going, wait a minute, I have to earn $50,000 a year to have that car and it can get banged up and it can, why would I do that? And I'm not living anymore anywhere, but I have that car. I'm driving that car. Well, I'm stupid if I'm driving that car. They all come out in the same place, and I don't care what socioeconomic level they're in.
I just want to make sure that we touch on the Children's Financial Network. Tell us about the mission and what inspired you to start it.
Well, the mission is really what we've discussed, to educate parents and kids about money so that they can grow up and be comfortable and make their own choices, regardless of their socioeconomic level. I mean, if you're way below the poverty line and you don't have food, that's not applicable. You're in survival mode. That's not what it is. But anyone else, I don't care if you have a ton of money. There's always someone richer. There's always someone poorer. We do not define ourselves by the money we have. It's not life's report card. Mm-hmm. We just don't do it. I see Doug's face. He's sending his children to me for a little bit for tutorials. I see.
Out of doubt, Neil. I mean, this is your calling, and you can tell that it's what you are fulfilled by, is teaching and educating and doing this.
And how lucky I am that I get to do something I want to do every single day. I get to work with people like you who, you know, share the vision and just need the tools to go out there and share it also. So I am incredibly lucky. I get to do what I do every day.
What do you like to do for fun, Neil? I mean, I know this is like huge fulfilling stuff. So what are we doing for fun?
All right. If I tell you, it's a little weird. I ride Grand Prix dressage horses in Spain. I've ridden my whole life. I've always figured out, with or without money, that I will ride. I searched the world. I found a place called Epona in Spain where they let schnooks like me train with them. And I went over there 20 years ago. I become friendly with these people. I love them. I'm one of the family. And I go twice a year and I ride Grand Prix dressage stallions. Let me repeat the word, stallions. And that's what I do. That's my passion.
Oh my gosh.
That is not what I was expecting.
Not at all. No, it's like almost like you picked this very niche type of extracurricular guy and then figured out, like, how do I get a career that allows me to do that?
Also, by the way, I'm passionate about travel. I've been to way over 100 countries. I've traveled with my children forever. Part of education is travel. And what I would do is make them read and journal, and we would have themes. My son was into animals, so we one year studied life at the equator and went to the Amazon, Africa, and the Galapagos, and we studied and had naturalists who studied, and then they have to go back and present to school. And my daughter was into more of a people thing, so we studied communism and went to Cuba and went to China.
Wow.
And compared the communism and did that. And I worked with the schools to say, I'm pulling them out because this is more educational. I will have the naturalist talk to you and we'll work at curricula, and they will read and they will journal and they will present. And that's what we're doing.
I think that's fantastic. I agree with you 100%. Travel is so important to show kids different cultures. And I personally feel like I would rather spend that money traveling with my kids than on a new countertop, because that's what they're going to take with them forever. Tell us what's happening next. What's on the horizon? What's our next project?
Next project is I just submitted my book, a manuscript about gray divorce, which is divorce after 50. It's written for women because women are filing for gray divorce more than men. It's the largest segment growing of divorce in our country over the last 10 years. And the book is going to be called Get Off Your Assets.
Neil, you are an absolute treasure. Really.
We're not worthy.
We have so much fun meeting you, and you really, you're going to elevate, you're going to bring that Oprah vibe to us, and you're going to elevate, you know, us going forward. But thank you for giving your time. Thank you for being so gracious with all your, you know, the history and your lessons. And a lot of our stopping by guests will have to get your books and learn your lessons. So thank you for your time. Thanks for stopping by, Neil.
This was great. Lots of fun. You guys are wonderful. I'm glad you've dedicated your lives to helping people design their financial lives. So thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.